Welcome to Circulation on the Run, your weekly podcast summary and backstage pass to the journal and its editors. We're your co-hosts. I'm Dr. Carolyn Lam, Associate Editor from the National Heart Center and Duke National University of Singapore.
And I'm Dr. Greg Hunley, Associate Editor, Director of the Poly Heart Center at VCU Health in Richmond, Virginia.
Today's feature paper is a very important discussion and, in fact, the first study to compare early versus delayed NOACs after acute ischemic stroke in patients with atrial fibrillation. The timing study. You're not going to want to miss this, but you're going to have to wait for it because we're going to discuss on the papers in today's issue. Can I start, Greg? Because I want to start, or is it too early to start, with a Greg quiz? With the quiz question being, what is cell-free DNA?
Oh, thank you, Dr. Lam. I really appreciate your wonderment into the world of preclinical science. So something, maybe short DNA fragments, but I'm not sure.
Aw, you're absolutely right. It's circulating DNA fragments, predominantly from mononucleosomes that represent cell injury and or turnover. So what we know is elevated total cell-free DNA concentration has been associated with worse prognosis in a variety of conditions, such as sepsis, trauma, malignancy. In addition, and this may be where a lot of us have heard of cell-free DNA, it's become clinically relevant as a non-invasive marker of solid organ transplant rejection, as well as a tool for genotyping and surveillance in oncology. However, in today's paper, given the parallels in the pathogenesis of pulmonary artery hypertension to the diseases I've talked about before that are characterized by increased cell proliferation and turnover, like the cancers and inflammatory-mediated tissue injury. Now, this particular study sought to determine if plasma cell-free DNA concentrations were elevated in pulmonary artery hypertension, and if those levels would correlate with disease severity or predict outcomes.
Oh, wow, Carolyn. This sounds really informative. So what did they find?
Well, this study from co-corresponding authors, Dr. Solomon from NIH Clinical Center and Dr. Agbor Eno from NHLBI in Bethesda and their team, found that circulating cell-free DNA is elevated in patients with pulmonary arterial hypertension compared to healthy controls. In two independent PAH patient cohorts, cell-free DNA concentrations increased with severity of disease and predicted transplant-free survival in the larger of the two cohorts. Interestingly, methylation patterns revealed increased cell-free DNA originating from biologically plausible sites, including erythrocyte progenitor and myeloid lineage inflammatory cells, vascular endothelium, and cardiac myocytes. So the implications are that in pulmonary arterial hypertension, cell-free DNA concentrations could serve as a non-invasive biomarker of underlying disease activity, may add prognostic value to currently used risk scores, and may provide a unique non-invasive window into its pathogenesis.
Wow, Carolyn. So another interesting technique and pathophysiologic study highlighting the utility of circulating cell-free DNA. Wow. Well, Carolyn, how about I start in with my first study, and it comes to us from the world of clinical science and refers to the Paradise MI echocardiographic substudy. So, Carolyn, the prospective ARNI versus ACE inhibitor trial to determine superiority in reducing heart failure events after myocardial infarction, so the Paradise MI echo study, tested the effect of salbutamol valsartan compared to ramipril on LV function and adverse remodeling following high-risk acute myocardial infarction. So this substudy included 544 Paradise MI participants that underwent echocardiography at randomization and then again later at 8 months. Patients were randomized within a half to 7 days of their presentation with their index myocardial infarction to receive a target dose of sacubitril valsartan of 200 milligrams or ramipril 5 milligrams twice daily.
All right. So the Paradise MI echo substudy, what did they find?
Right, Carolyn. So treatment with sacubitril valsartan compared to ramipril following acute myocardial infarction did not result in changes in left ventricular ejection fraction or left atrial volume at 8 months. Patients randomized to sacubitril valsartan had less LV enlargement and greater improvement in filling pressure. And thus, there are new insights here in that treatment with sacubitril valsartan compared to ramipril early following acute myocardial infarction may beneficially impact LV size and diastolic properties, possibly due to reductions in LV filling pressure.
Oh, very nice, Greg. Thank you. Another clinical study here, and this time a paper aimed to evaluate the influence of sex on the effects of empagliflozin in patients with HFpEF enrolled in the EMPEROR PRESERVE trial.
Ah, Carolyn, two of your favorite things, sex differences and SGLT2 inhibitors. So, Carolyn, remind us, what did EMPEROR PRESERVED show us?
Ah, so EMPEROR PRESERVED studied the sodium glucose cotransporter 2, or SGLT2 inhibitor, empagliflozin in patients with HFpEF, which is an ejection fraction above 40%, and showed a significant reduction in the risk of cardiovascular death or heart failure hospitalization. In the current paper, corresponding author Dr. Javed Butler from University of Mississippi Medical Center and colleagues found that empagliflozin reduced the risk of the primary outcome of cardiovascular death or hospitalization for heart failure to a similar degree in both women and men with HFpEF, irrespective of baseline left ventricular ejection fraction. Empagliflozin produced comparable benefits for the pre-specified secondary outcomes of total heart failure hospitalizations, cardiovascular death, and all-cause mortality, as well as physiologic measures and health status. The pattern of the effects of empagliflozin and HFpEF in both sexes in EMPEROR PRESERVE stands in contrast to the influence of sex on the response to neprilysin inhibition. So, very interesting paper. I encourage everyone to pick it up, of course, because it's two of my favorite topics.
Very nice, Carolyn. Well, my next paper comes to us from the world of preclinical science, and it's from Dr. Shunyu Zhang from Daiping Hospital, the Third Military Medical University. Carolyn, adverse environmental exposure during the prenatal period can lead to diseases in offspring, including hypertension. Now, whether or not the hypertensive phenotype can be transgenerationally transmitted is really not known.
Wow, that's interesting. So what did this paper find?
Kellen, this was really interesting. So these authors in a rat model, they found that prenatal lipopolysaccharide exposure can impair the ability to excrete a salt load and induce hypertension from the first to the third generations, with the fourth and fifth generations inducing salt-sensitive hypertension. And Carolyn, really interestingly, and based on these findings, they treated lipopolysaccharide-exposed pregnant rats with the reactive oxygen species scavenger Tempol, which successfully prevented hypertension in the first-generation offspring and the transgenerational inheritance of hypertension. So, Carolyn, these findings show that adverse prenatal exposure induces transgenerational hypertension through an epigenetic regulated mechanism, and these findings identify potentially preventive and therapeutic strategies for this form of generationally transmitted hypertension. Really interesting.
Wow, that sounds wild. Very, very interesting. Well, let's go through the other things that are in today's issue. There's a research letter by Dr. Moyedi on anteroposterior pacer pad position is more likely to capture than anterolateral for transcutaneous cardiac pacing.
Great, Carol. And I've got a research letter from Professor Perello entitled Defining the Fetal Gene Program at Single Cell Resolution in Pediatric Dilated Cardiomyopathy. And then lastly, there's an ECG challenge from Dr. Chen entitled A Shark Fin Electrocardiogram in the Intensive Care Unit. Well, Carolyn, how about we get on to that feature discussion and learn more about non-vitamin K antagonists after acute ischemic stroke?
Yep, in patients with AF, here we go. Today's feature discussion is all about atrial fibrillation, how it's a risk factor for stroke, but also about how we've never known really how soon after an acute stroke can we start oral anticoagulation to prevent recurrent strokes. Today, we're going to talk about the timing study. It's the first randomized controlled study to evaluate the efficacy and safety of initiation of treatment with NOACs within 10 days of acute ischemic stroke in patients with atrial fibrillation. Wow, what an exciting study. And also, how exciting that we have two co-first authors. We have Dr. Jonas Olgren and Dr. Signil Osberg from Uppsala University in Sweden. And this represents a partnership between neurology and cardiology. I mean, really unique in many aspects, as well as the way this study was performed, which is truly, truly a feat in itself. May I ask you both, please, to tell me the story of how this study came to be in the first place?
Well, we'd like to mention the late Professor Andreas Torrent, who actually was the first to bring this question to the table. And together we talked with the cardiology department and Jonas Olgren to see if we can collaborate to solve this important question for us that works with stroke patients, because it's on a weekly or even a daily basis, troublesome question.
And I mean, wow. My background is as a cardiologist and professor of coagulation research, I've been very interested in anticoagulants, antithrombotic treatments, and had the pleasure and privilege to be part of the development of the novel oral anticoagulants. And in all those pivotal trials, we excluded patients with a recent stroke, at least 7 days from the stroke, sometimes even 30 days from the acute stroke. We excluded them from the studies. So when we found the exciting results with at least as good efficacy as warfarin and at least as good safety as warfarin and the tremendous reduction in intracerebral or intracranial bleeds, that was a finding which was not evaluated in acute stroke patients with atrial fibrillation. And when Andreas Torrent and Signil approached me with this idea, I said, well, this is absolutely a very important question. And why hasn't it been resolved earlier? And the problem is, of course, that these are patients who are in a sensible setting early after the acute ischemic stroke. And when are we able to safely start an effective treatment?
Oh, I couldn't agree more with you about how important that is. I mean, when we have an acute stroke patient, we just don't know whether we should start the NOAC early or delay it. And we definitely need that evidence gap filled. But I'm also so intrigued with the way you did it with the Swedish stroke register. I mean, what a powerful way to look at important questions like this. Could you tell us a bit more about the method used?
Yeah, so in cardiology, we started rather early by using our national health registries for doing randomized controlled trials. We did a lot of observational studies in our registries, both in stroke and in cardiovascular medicine, otherwise, and in every other area of medicine. But in the end, we realized that we could at best be hypothesis generating, but we still needed to add randomized controlled studies to have the last piece of the puzzle to provide good evidence. And then we ran a lot of studies in cardiology, especially in myocardial infarction patients, by just adding to simplify it, by adding a randomization module and then follow the patients in the registries, because we know that we have high quality data in the registry, for instance, in the stroke registry. So we anyway collect every important data on each and every patient in the registry. So by adding a randomization module, we can facilitate the conduct of a clinical study.
Wow, the way you say it, you make it sound so simple, but I can tell you what you have there in Sweden is like the envy of the whole world. And everybody's thinking about how to do a registry-based trial like that. So, you know, maybe after you tell us the results, you could also share a little bit of how difficult and challenging it can be as well. But would either of you like to share the results?
Well, the major result from our trial is that initiating NOAC within 4 days is non-inferior to starting in a delayed phase of up to 10 days. So that's our key finding. But equally important is that we didn't have any patients experiencing a symptomatic intracerebral hemorrhage. And that is extremely good news for us who work with these patients.
Yeah, that is such an important message. The early initiation was non-inferior. Could you expand on non-inferior in terms of what primary outcome?
Yeah, so the primary outcome was really a clinically important outcome, we think, both from the cardiology perspective, but also from stroke specialists. So we had a combination, a composite of symptomatic intracerebral hemorrhages, ischemic strokes, and death. And this is what matters to patients and to doctors. We would like to avoid strokes. And it doesn't matter if it's an ischemic stroke or if it's a hemorrhagic stroke. We would like to avoid them. And of course, we would not like to have an increased mortality as well. So it's a relevant endpoint. And when we designed the study, the main drug used was warfarin. And there we knew that there was a lot of hemorrhagic transformations and a lot of intracerebral hemorrhages. So we designed the trial to look at these three endpoints, to prevent stroke, ischemic stroke, but to avoid hemorrhagic strokes. And that is why we choose to have a non-inferiority design, because we also have the advantage of starting early. We can make the decision to start with the stroke specialist, sometimes in collaboration with the cardiologist. And then we can have the patient step down unit earlier if the treatment is already started. So that was the choice of a non-inferiority design. We, all, of course, also tested for superiority, but unfortunately, we didn't meet that superiority testing endpoint. But as Signal mentioned, I think a thrilling result is to have no symptomatic intracerebral hemorrhage in any of the groups. That really speaks in favor of the safety of this drug or these drugs that we used, but also the concept to start early. We can also note that we had some, I mean, there were numerically lower rates of both ischemic strokes and deaths in the early group, albeit not meeting the significance for superiority, but it's important. And as we see also, the events tend to occur very early. So we really gain with treating our patients earlier with this intervention.
Oh, indeed. And to all the listeners, do pick up the paper, because if you look at the Kaplan-Meier curves, they're really impressive. Exactly like you said, numerical differences, although the trial did demonstrate non-inferiority and could not demonstrate the superiority. But have a look at those figures. And if I could just clarify, the comparator arm, notice that we've been saying NOACs, not a particular NOAC. So could you expand on that a bit?
So we used all the 4 NOACs that we have in Sweden. So that was to the physician's discretion to choose between them. So that was not a part of the randomization. So we only randomized the timing to the early phase or the delayed phase.
I love that. And then if you could please educate the cardiologist in me, please, Signal. You know, there are symptomatic intracerebral hemorrhages, and then there are all kinds of little things that you can pick up if you image the brain, and hemorrhagic transformation and microbleeds and all these things. So I think one of the things here is, was there systematic imaging, and does it matter? Could you teach us a little bit more about these different types of bleeds?
We did not have a systematic imaging, but in Sweden, that is performed mostly by CT on admission. So that was for all patients. And then on events, the imaging was performed and reported through the registry. And yes, there were hemorrhagic transformation in three patients, two in the first, in the early phase, and one in the delayed full phase, but only one before day 10. So there are all blood that was seen on imaging was reported, but we used symptomatic criteria from the stroke severity scale.
Thank you. That's a good clarification. And then, you know, the study aimed for a larger number. And here, perhaps, if either of you could tell us the story, you know, the struggles and how you ended up with this beautiful results.
Yeah, struggle is the word. It was troublesome. And we had long talks of why was this happening? Why didn't the sites recruit more? But I think one issue might have been that NOACs had been on the market for a while once we started. And even the stroke physicians were getting used to it and had trouble not to start. Before the timing study started, we did an observational pre-timing study just to see how we were doing in Sweden at this stage, because we didn't really know that. We know that a lot of patients were discharged with oral anticoagulation, but we didn't really know when they started. And so by that study, we could see that a median time to initiation was 5 days already before the timing study. So one thought was that this was for some physicians that had to delay their start. They were getting used to start early. So that could have been one explanation.
And of course, there has been a lot of observational studies looking at the safety of NOACs or other oral anticoagulants in the early setting after acute ischemic stroke in patients with atrial fibrillation. And of course, with the evidence from such studies, albeit observational, doctors felt perhaps more confident starting very early, despite the lack of evidence from randomized controlled trials. So we had the opportunity to follow those patients as well. In the stroke registry, every patient with an acute stroke in Sweden attending a stroke unit is registered. So we have in the supplement to the paper in circulation, we have observational data from the centers participating in stroke, but patients not randomized in the timing study. And we also have observational data from all stroke centers in Sweden. So we can see that many start very early with NOACs based on observational data, based on experiences, and perhaps were more and more reluctant to randomize the patient in the study because, as Signal says, that means there is a 50% chance of delayed treatment by randomization. And when we started the study, there were no evidence from randomized controlled trials within the first 14 days. But while running the study for a couple of years, you start to believe that there seemed to be safety because no one saw any symptomatic intracerebral hemorrhage. And we discussed that, of course, at investigator meetings, that this seems to be a very good treatment, which is bad for running a clinical study, but it's, of course, good for the patients.
Interesting. So equipoise kind of may have shifted a little bit even during the course of the trial. So just thank you so much. All the more thank you for seeing this to completion in the sense of a beautiful manuscript with very meaningful results. If I could ask you both to each summarize just very quickly what the take-home message is for clinical practice from neurologist point of view and cardiologist point of view.
Yeah. What I would say, it seems both safe and reasonable to initiate NOAC early after an acute ischemic stroke. So I think that's the key take-home message, that really to consider the acute secondary prevention.
I may bring that from another perspective. I think when there's lack of data, in collaboration, we can do a lot. So in this case, we had a great collaboration in the steering committee, cardiologists and stroke specialists collaborating to run such a study. And we are extremely grateful for all the sites and all the investigators at the sites participating in the study. And of course, grateful to Circulation for publishing it, because we are very proud of this study.
And we are proud to be publishing this. So, ladies and gentlemen, you heard it right here in Circulation on the Run. Remember, this is about early versus delayed initiation of NOACs in patients after an acute stroke who also have atrial fibrillation. And this is a very, very, I think, important study that fills an important evidence gap. We're so grateful to both of you for being here to discuss it. And to the audience for listening today. You've been listening to Circulation on the Run, and don't forget to tune in again next week.
This program is copyright of the American Heart Association 2022. The opinions expressed by speakers in this podcast are their own and not necessarily those of the editors or of the American Heart Association. For more, please visit ahajournals.org.